at this time every day, usually when I've been recording videos and stuff for Ambition, had sodding like supersonic jets go, well, not supersonic, but jets flying over.
Welcome to Thinking Deeply About Primary Education, the podcast that makes time and space to think about pedagogy, teaching and learning, professional development, anything of interest to time-poor but enthusiasm-rich primary teachers. This week, I'm joined by Christopher Such.
Hello again.
It's good to see you, Chris. Bit of a different episode again this week. We're going to throw questions back and forth between us. I think first, probably worth giving a shout out to Shannon, who, you know, one-time contributor to the podcast, has recently had Ofsted, and as far as I can tell, it was a pretty positive experience. So well done, Shannon. But yeah, we're gonna throw questions back and forth. We haven't seen the questions, and really, I've got a group of questions that I knew were in my Twitter DMs, but you know, you get them when you're busy, and then you forget about them, and your Twitter DMs are full of mess because you get people spamming you. And then, you know, so I thought, well, okay, well, let's address some of these and see what you think, Chris. So my first question is, do you have a recommended list of manipulatives, minimum basic outline, that support the key stage three maths curriculum?
Key stage three. Now, that's an interesting one. I spoke to Sylvia about this recently, and she said that the two that she couldn't live without, and I know two doesn't sound like many, but the two that she absolutely couldn't live without are algebra tiles and double-sided counters. Double-sided counters particularly useful for various things relating to negative numbers. Algebra tiles, apparently an incredibly versatile thing to be involved with. I've seen them used in videos. I've never had the opportunity to use them myself when I was doing a little bit of Key Stage 3 intervention, to my shame. It didn't involve a great deal of manipulatives. It was right at the start of my career before I knew about the value of this stuff. But I have to say that when I spoke to Sylvia and then asked her to ask her colleagues, the two that kept coming back were double-sided counters and algebra tiles. So while there might be loads of other stuff that you can employ, in fact, I'm certain there are. I've no doubt there are ways to use Cuisenaire rods, etc. I would say that actually starting with one or two manipulatives, working out how they can be incredibly valuable across the curriculum, really mastering them, making sure that you've, even little things like work, you've worked out how to logistically store and get them out in your classroom, getting comfortable with a couple might be a really good place to begin. One thing I would say though, if I'm looking at Key Stage 3, so much of that is consolidating what has or hasn't been learned in Key Stage 2, I would be very hard pressed to not also have class sets of deans, i.e. base 10, because I think so much of year 7 involves consolidating, as I said, particularly stuff relating to place value and arithmetic. And I think it's really difficult to get into that place value stuff without, particularly relating to decimals, without deans. I mean, ideally, you might complement that with place value counters as well, so that you can use the deans for decimals and the place value counters for numbers up to 1 million, etc. But if in doubt, I think you could certainly get away with just double-sided counters, algebra tiles, according to my partner at least, but I would probably want to include some deans in there as well.
Yeah, I think that's a solid answer. I mean, we've got to consider that, as well as the maths being very similar to that we experience in Key Stage 2, lots of the pupils coming up will probably, the right maths for them will probably be primary mathematics or the mathematics that we typically encounter in primary. So for me, you've got to look at this as like a sequence the whole way through. Like you're talking about two-color counters. Talk about it all the time. They're just as powerful in with a two-year-old as they are with a 15-year-old, 16-year-old. And so we're looking at threads across our primary schools into our secondary schools, and then obviously trying to bridge that gap, because you're going to have pupils who will need primary mathematics or instruction in areas of primary mathematics, but also you're trying to tell a story. And if the pupils are familiar with the characters, i.e. the 10 frames, 5 frames, you know, for fractions and things, then there's a little bit less heavy lifting to do when it comes to exploring this new concept. Because obviously you know how important things like ratio are in Key Stage 3 and Key Stage 4. And because you really get into the weeds of those topics, you know, we sort of touch on it. And I know this person in particular who asked this question has responsibility across different phases, potentially, certainly across a number of schools. And so it might be helpful for them to think about the story that their representation or their model selection tells over the course of 14 years, in addition to what it tells over this very short snapshot of secondary school. You know, the pedant in me wants to ask about your take on Dinesh equipment and whether or not we should start using that on the podcast. But I also, you know, I'm the kind of person who asks for two cappuccini in a coffee shop, and then the person goes, what do you want? So I don't know, because most people recognize Dean's equipment. I mean, this is probably the time to make a decision how we move forward.
It's a good question. I mean, in the end, I'm keen to communicate clearly with as many people as possible. And, you know, where I've said like Dinesh blocks, I tend to get quizzical looks as well. So I tend to stick with Dean's. It doesn't stop me saying subitizing though, instead of subitizing, but I kind of figure that that's easier to work out. Yeah, I mean, that is a tricky one, obviously, because it relates to a person's name. So there's an element of kind of respectfulness and cultural sensitivity there. But yeah, so that is a tricky one. Maybe the way forward is to say Dean's, also known as Dinesh, or vice versa, as a way of covering all bases. Just going back to something you said a moment ago as well, though, this idea of having responsibility across a number of phases. I guess the question about manipulatives in Key Stage 3 inevitably like raises the question, or the further question, about ideal practice. And what you said there about recognizing that lots of pupils who arrive in Key Stage 3 aren't going to necessarily have the foundation, the mathematical foundations in place that we'd want them to have. Yeah. I mean, you can't then help but think, well, what else do we really need to be there? Like, in reality, I think lots of secondary schools, in terms of supporting their the pupils who struggle most with mathematics, the most they do is take a scheme from somewhere and say, okay, we'll start in year 5 instead of, you know, year 6 or year 7. And obviously, for lots of pupils, that's relatively inadequate. I know that my partner Sylvia has kind of really changed her practice over recent years when working with those pupils who need the foundations. And she works with 10 frames. She works with double-sided counters within them. But generally, she uses them under a visualizer. So she's using them as something to show rather than something for the pupils necessarily to use. And that seems to be quite an effective balance there. And so I guess we get into a further discussion, inevitably, about firstly, what is ideal practice in secondary mathematics? And I wouldn't want to speak too much to that, obviously, given my inexperience. But we also get into the question about when do we need manipulatives and when can manipulatives be used either like a digital equivalent, which is just for modeling on the interactive whiteboard, or a proper version of manipulatives that is used just by the teacher under the visualizer. So one thing I might say is that, yes, you've got your set of what of the manipulatives you want to use in Key Stage 3. You might want to expand that a little more in terms of what the teacher has available to model stuff regularly under the visualizer.
Don't need an excuse, but I think we should bring Johnny Hall in, or try and bring Johnny in and talk, because I was just thinking about MathSpot, because I know this week he has recently updated his algebra ties. I think it was his algebra ties to assign questions to the representations or something along those lines. It seemed like a really interesting tweak he'd made to his resources. But obviously he's got manipulatives that go beyond those that are affordable. Because essentially, if you could think of it, Johnny has made it. So worth checking out MathSpot. But this conversation could very easily be the next 60 minutes. So I think I'm going to see if I can get him on, and we can explore Key Stage 3 in depth before the new academic year.
Yeah, sounds amazing. Sylvia used MathSpot a little while ago to kind of reteach me the idea of completing the square, which is something I learned in an entirely abstract way when I was at school and never really got to grips with to the extent that I'd like. And yeah, it blew my mind how much more it made sense. Obviously, that's with the years of kind of thinking about that stuff a bit further. But yeah, it would be great to hear from him. This question relates in part to some of the things you've been discussing recently on the podcast relating to Key Stage 1, but more specifically to assessment. So here's the scenario I want you to run with. I want you to imagine that Ofsted, SATs, all kind of accountability measures and pressures disappear tomorrow. And you are working with a school or a group of schools, and they've asked you specifically to put in place a system of assessment that's purely for the purposes of supporting learning. There's no other reason it needs to exist. It's purely for helping pupils learn and including the longer journey. So you might be using information to inform at like transition days when they go up to year seven, that kind of stuff. The question I would ask is, well, what if you had your run of a school under those circumstances, what kind of assessments would you put in place from reception to year six? I mean, that's quite a big question, but generally, what would that look like?
Am I the government or a teacher or like a subject leader?
Oh, you're kind of subject leader in charge of a school. So you've got freedom to respond to the needs. Let's assume it's an average two form entry primary school, say.
It's a really good question. I mean, my gut says I'm not necessarily interested in summative information. I think there are too many issues with reliability and validity, but I know that I'm potentially an outlier in adopting that position. I mean, I remember once listening to, I think it was Bruno Reddy talking on the Mr. Barton Maths podcast, and he spoke about the system he had in place at King Solomon, where essentially the teacher would have a mark book and they would very quickly acknowledge pupils' success or failure. I don't know if failure is the wrong word, but you know, whether pupils got the hinge question at the end of a lesson or the end of a sequence correct or not. And I think that's sufficient information for our purposes, because ultimately what we want to do is we want to find out what pupils know. We want to find out what they don't know and then teach them just on the edge of their understanding. And I think if we trust in that approach, then the big picture takes care of itself. Because I think we're far too driven as a profession, and probably across the world, by these end of phase or key point grand tests of student capacity. You know, I mean, public policy being driven by PISA, PIRLS, those kind of things, they have their detractors, don't they? You know, I mean, they're quote unquote the best we've got. But the amount of money that's being spent around the world because of those tests, I don't know. I'd really love someone with a keen financial mind. You know, one of those guys who do the fraud cases for the FBI to really unpick the cost benefit ratio of money spent based on summative assessments, and same with end of key stage assessments too. I think the big picture takes care of itself. What I think is that we want to have a sense of control over something that we can't necessarily control, because it will be the responsibility of the teacher in that moment to identify which pupils are ready for the next bit, which pupils need corrective instruction, that kind of thing. But I'm sure there must have been a time when schools didn't have that much control over what happened in the classroom. You know, I'm thinking of the old days where the teacher was the most respected person after the priest and the doctor in the community. And, you know, it would have been trusted that the education of the children was going to be fine. Now, maybe that's too lax and we need some sort of oversight. But I think our priority needs to be formative in nature. And that's where I would focus all my attention. I really don't care about summative snapshots, because the inferences we can draw are many. And, you know, you can spin it any way you like, really, at the end of the day. What's it telling you that you didn't already know? I don't know.
Is there anything kind of systematic that you would put in place on a whole school level that was purely required for formative purposes? So, for example, if I'm thinking about reading, if, you know, there were no, you know, end of key stage one, sorry, end of year one phonics screening check, if that didn't exist, I would still probably be, I'd want something systematic in place. If not, say at the end of year one, it might be more flexible than that. It might come more little and often, but I'd probably say I'd still want end of reception, end of year one, maybe every term, perhaps very brief checks on pupils' understanding of the relationships between letters and sounds and their ability to blend. I'd probably have something a bit further down the line as well, maybe year two, year three, to see how that's developing now that they're responding to texts. I have the same thing kind of with fluency, so that teachers, in order to inform something systematic to inform interventions. Is there, do you think that mathematics, to some extent at least, has certain core aspects that would be worth saying, I can't obviously know everything, but there's this little bit of these core things that we might have a systematic approach to? Or would you say that you want something kind of more flexible, entirely kind of teacher judgment based for everything?
I mean, I've obviously listened to you talk about this kind of stuff lots, and particularly quite a bit recently. And I'm totally on board with the idea of those frequent checks. But I do think that, you know, while there could be some sort of standardization in the materials, they could be the preserve of the class teacher to utilize, because we know, I mean, maybe I'm misinterpreting the data, but the 32 spike in the phonics check suggests something's amiss. People haven't learned how to game the multiplication check yet. Can't remember what the exact figure was, but it was pretty much identical to last year. So there wasn't a massive jump, not as far as I can remember. So I think those kind of things, when they're on a national level, there's an incentive to game them because you're being held accountable on, the, you know, in terms of the school. So I think we should, yeah, produce materials that allowed you to check, because those things are important. Being able to decode the English language is very important. Knowing your multiplication tables is very important. I mean, I like the fact that there's a check, because I think it helps people, schools to prioritize. But in my ideal world, schools take responsibility for that themselves, because they understand how important those ideas are, you know, because like we always say, 5 and 6 get unlocked by knowledge of times tables. And so that's probably the approach I would take. Because again, when we have these large scale comparisons, there's an incentive to do the bare minimum, I think. But I don't know what the 32 is telling us, really. But you know, it seems sus.
Oh yeah, the 32 spike in the phonics screening check is very sus. And I like to think, if not, I'm certain, in fact, that if schools were not held accountable via that information, there are negative sides to that initially, because you don't see schools recognizing that this is now a priority. And obviously schools, school leaders, teachers do respond to these incentives. That's why they exist. But now that people recognize, or are beginning to recognize, I think, the value of this stuff, I think if these weren't used for accountability purposes in such a strict way, then I like to think that spike would disappear, as schools would start to just be more ready to just, you know, let the chips fall as they may in with these assessments, rather than unconsciously, I would imagine, kind of offering extra support where required in order to get pupils to where they think they need to be. Or, you know, little bits and pieces. If you teach a kid phonics every day and you know they know these sound spelling correspondences, and they just kind of trip over a word a little bit, and you think maybe have not blended something correctly, and then you kind of nudge them, you give them a little bit more time. Oh yeah, they've got it right now. And it just gets them over that line at 32. That isn't going to feel, and isn't, you know, cheating as it were in any recognizable form. But across the whole scale of what's going on in, you know, an assessment system, this accumulation of completely understandable nudges is always going to kind of get just enough kids over the line at 32 to leave this spike. I guess the reason I brought this up was, in effect, I wondered whether, when it comes to things like times tables, whether it, when it comes to number bonds, when it comes arguably to you know, ability to count and subitize in reception, whether there was anything, whether you would say, leave it kind of up to the teachers to say, okay, you know, I know this kid's number bonds are where they're at, tick. That's all I'm, that's all I need to say to the next teacher as I pass them up from year one to year two or year two to year three, or whether in your kind of ideal world, you would support that with some kind of like ready-made assessment where you'd say, look, as you get towards the end of year one, take 5 minutes to do this little assessment with all of the year one kids before you have move, before they have move up day, before you talk to next year's teacher. So you've got a slightly better grasp of where they're at for, I don't know, yeah, number bonds inside 10 or number bonds inside 20 or whatever, wherever they're working.
I mean, in terms of making things systematic across and rolling them out across all schools, you know, for that, I mean, I was thinking if I had my, you know, if I carte blanche do what I wanted, some sort of system that helped pupils to record the information that they're taking in. Because obviously a mark sheet, it's only going to tell you so much, but a heat map, for instance, and it could be a heat map for general curricular concerns, but also for those key facts. I don't think there's a better representation of what a pupil's strengths and weaknesses might be, you know? So if there were some way of capturing pupil responses, you know, and if, and I'm sure there are lots of different ways that this can happen, but, you know, capturing those responses and then collating the data into some sort of really sort of easily interpretable form would be useful, I think. Because, yeah, because because one of the things is you need to be really explicit about which bonds the kids don't know when you're passing them on. You know, there's no point in doing all the number bonds within 20 and 10 because it's maybe over 100. And I think probably if you were to do one a week, it would take you the best part of nursery reception in year one. So, I'm probably, because this is an unseen question, I've reduced it down to sort of the bare bones, you know, because everything you're saying, I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe I'll develop this. But it's, I think at its heart, anything that can help us be responsive in the moment is probably the most effective use of our time and money.
It's been a little while since I, you know, accidentally made it sound like I work for Numbots, but it wouldn't surprise me if part of what Numbots and Times Table Rockstars offer as part of the kind of the assessment that accumulates over time are kind of heat maps relating to number bonds that pupils are struggling with, or heat maps related to multiplication facts that they're struggling with. I might be wrong about that.
This next one came via Research Aid Surrey. And for a bit of context, the person who posed the question and myself were part of the audience, or the people who went to see Christian Stills talk at Research Aid Surrey. And he was talking, obviously, about test-enhanced learning. And this person asked him a question, and then he suggested asking me too. And because, obviously, you're at a conference, I have forgotten that I had this message until I went back to look at my messages, and I feel really bad about it. So I thought we'd give some time. And actually, because you potentially have worked with Christian quite a bit, certainly spoken to Christian quite a bit, you might be really well placed to answer this. So I'm a maths lead and year six teacher. At the beginning of each lesson, we use something called Fluent in Five, which is, I think, your typical retrieval practice setup. And after hearing Christian's talk, where he spoke about 94% you get the question we're asking right, and it got this person thinking, you know, in their class, roughly 90 to 95% get the first question right. The second question drops to about 75, 80% of the class. And then the last two might be about 60%. 40% of the pupils were on track, we're talking about assessment, when they came up, but now it's roughly 70%. So it seems like this is having an impact. But it's difficult to know whether some of the questions being more challenging would be a hindrance to the learners or not.
I think this is one of these areas, and I'm tempted to say this, obviously, because of my ignorance of the subject, but I think this is one of these areas where we need to be careful about over-interpreting what we know about things like retrieval practice, because all of these things, useful though they are often done in conditions that aren't the same as a classroom. I remember having a conversation when I was fortunate enough to speak to Craig Barton a while back, talking to him about the fact that all of this stuff that looks like best practice often is only best practice when we take into account loads of other things. So for example, maybe desirable difficulties in terms of the retrieval you're asking pupils to do, and it is, you know, a really sensible thing, a really great way to maximize learning. But, and this is the point I'm coming to, but if you are also taking into account motivation at this point, you've got pupils who are struggling, you've got pupils who have found learning difficult, and you think, no, they need some success. At that point, these calculations of what percentage should I get, do I want them getting right, they become much more nuanced. So I guess the short answer I would say is, when it comes to retrieval practice, I think there's loads of value in kids doing stuff that they get right. I suspect there's lots of value in kids struggling with stuff as well, and then you putting support in place. I think we had a conversation a long time ago, Kieran, where you opened my eyes to the value of retrieval practice where pupils don't get the right answer, and the potential for that leading to as much learning as when they do, as long as you then kind of go through the answer. But obviously, just like the extra component that comes into this always is motivation. So I think really you have to reflect on what's happening in the class. I think if lots of pupils are struggling with the retrieval practice questions, or being successful with some, not with others, but you're not seeing a knock to motivation, then I say, you know, play with it. Like, let them have some questions where you've got to the end of this bit of retrieval practice and you're thinking, and they're thinking, yeah, what is the answer to that one? Oh, I know we did that 3 weeks ago, but I haven't got it. That can be a spur to new learning. It can be a really interesting thing for kids if their sense of self-efficacy and motivation is already in that really positive space. If it isn't, on the other hand, then I would be really tempted to err towards much higher degrees of success. You know, I'd be looking at, I want the vast majority of pupils to be getting the vast majority of questions correct. So in short, I think that the potential downside of these most of questions that are more likely to make pupils struggle relates to motivation and pupils' sense of self-efficacy. And we need to think, when might risking failure on a regular basis be more appropriate, and when it might not.
I think you're spot on, Chris. We used to do, well, the school still does it, a lot of things to mitigate for the fact that high success is key to driving motivation, as opposed to the other way about. It's fairly typical in these kinds of situations for pupils to be reluctant to engage with the process. Many, many factors for that, some societal, some perhaps based on the experience of school they've had so far. So the things we put in place include a realignment of the purpose. So for instance, being very clear about the power of retrieval practice with children as young as five, explaining to them that the thought of trying to remember this will make a new, stronger memory in your mind. That's central to everything we do. And every time I introduce it with a new teacher, and every time the teachers talk to their class about it, that's what they're talking about. They're talking about, this is why we do this. We set them up against themselves and no one else. So it's, you know, can you improve on your previous score? Or the next time this type of question comes up, can you get closer to the correct response? We identify different stages at which we would like pupils to engage if they don't have the stamina. Like, for instance, say they find mathematics difficult, they don't have mastery of the key sort of fundamentals, they're going to spend a whole lot more time on one problem in year five than they are if they have all those things in place. So for instance, you might say, okay, we've got five questions today, but initially, you know, you must answer the first two. And then over the, you know, this is in September, over the course of the year, we're getting closer and closer to the five. But I just make sure that the two questions I want them to really think about are the first two posed, and not necessarily the hardest questions, but the most important questions, perhaps the most pertinent to the learning that's going forward. And then, as you say, modeling the correct answer and discussing the reasoning behind it as part of the process. You know, so if you're thinking maybe 10, 15 minute window, 5 of that is engaging with the questions, perhaps 10 of that is engaging with the model, then I think you get kids towards the point where they're engaging with this and they're sufficiently motivated because they've got the right attitude towards self-improvement, I think. So yeah, a long way of saying I agree with what you said, Chris, but here's some things that we did that we found successful. Because in 2017, retrieval practice wasn't something that we engaged with. And, you know, the end of KCS2 assessments weren't in a strong place. And so we knew we needed to put something in place that would help pupils retain information and to then go on and use that. And over the course of 5-6 years, you know, the school has gone on from strength to strength. So that would be my recommendation. But at a minimum, we want to make sure pupils perceive themselves as pupils who can engage with whatever subject it is. And that sometimes starts with simplifying the process and then ramping it up, you know. So it will be case by case specific, I think.
Love it. Like, one caveat to everything I said was that Christian Still's book, Test Enhanced Learning, is on my to be read pile. And that is almost unconscionable of me. But I've been going through lots of other stuff relating to reading and lots of stuff relating to the work that I do. So I haven't got round to it yet, but I look forward to doing so. And I suspect that a more nuanced answer to this question might have been forthcoming had I had the opportunity to read it by now. But yeah, I look forward to doing so.
I mean, Christian obviously answered the question at the end of the session, I think. So he's already given his spin. And I mean, what Christian does really well is that he ties everything into his practice and he doesn't necessarily use too many maths examples, lots of English examples, because, you know, being an English teacher, that makes perfect sense. So you get a broader understanding, I think, by engaging with Christian's work than, because lots of the source material is based on mathematics quite often, you know. So definitely worth checking out. It's actually sitting on my desk again, maybe going for a third read, but I've read it twice this year. So I, you know, there are other books I need to engage with first.
Okay, so my turn to fire another question at you. It's about language in mathematics and the pedagogical language that we use. At one school I worked at, there was a real acceptance of that it was absolutely fine for teachers to say things like 3 and 4 make 7. Even when, you know, it's just abstract numbers on the board, so 3 plus 4 is equal to 7 is written on the board, it's perfectly fine for a teacher to say 3 and 4 make 7. I've also worked in environments where schools are really tight on language and say, we don't want to be using that kind of metaphorical language of make ever, you know, not if we're talking about abstract symbols on the board. And I wondered whether you have a particular position on that argument. So what I mean by that is, are you happy with kind of more colloquial expressions that pupils will come across in mathematics, or do you seek greater precision in that? One other kind of example of that that might kind of get to what I'm trying to say, teachers, I've seen teachers say, and I've used it myself, you know, 7 subtract 5 is equal to 2, or subtract, we should really say, you know, subtract is a verb that doesn't quite work like that. We should really say, you know, 5 subtracted from, I believe. I mean, I know I've been pulled up on that in the past. And yet pupils are going to come across subtract using that way. What, in other words, what is your take on this? Do you kind of hope for a certain level of precision and then explain this colloquial stuff? Or are you happy for kids to pick up the variety of language that is used in mathematics from just the, you know, the range of experiences they'll have with teachers?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, I would go for minus as an adjective. So 7 minus 5.
Personally, if I'm describing an equation on a board, it's plus, it's minus, it's multiplied by, it's divided by. I prefer any of those two. Yeah. You can't, obviously 7 add 5, kind of fine as well, but it's that same thing as subtract. I mean, 7 add 5. Well, I prefer to describe the symbols on the board, but the question then is, beyond our own preferences, like, you're leading maths in a school, say, are you kind of nudging teachers towards that language, or are you happy to accept a kind of a broader array?
Yeah, no, I understood this question this time, not unlike the last one. So I was just leading up to it with a specific point on minus, but I think it's not an equal system. There's no parity between schools in this respect, or no parity between pupils in this respect, because we're just like manipulatives. Where pupils understand and have a really robust understanding of the mathematics, it's fine not to use concrete resources with them. You know, it's implicit that they have an understanding of what's happening, and then you can use the shorthand, which is the symbolic notation, to describe these, you know, reasonably big concepts. The same is probably true for language. If I know a pupil understands this, we're going to be going pretty quickly through something until we get to the point where they don't understand. So I think there might be instances where actually it's fine, because you're, as long as the communication isn't hindered. Well, you know, I know in Singapore, once they know their pupils will fully understand place value and multiplicative reasoning in terms of magnitude, well, they will say, oh, let's just add a zero. You know, that's in their curricular documents, because they know that the pupils don't think zero is being added to it, you know, but they don't need to spend so much time on the nuts and bolts, so to speak. So there are examples in the real world where that happens. You know, obviously you have to be in a position where you are confident that the pupil you're working with, the group of pupils you're working with, understand the mathematics to such an extent that you can take these shortcuts, or you can use shorthand in those situations. Where pupils don't understand, where they have had a patchy experience of mathematics, where they've, you know, missed time at school, or where they just haven't got to that point where they can manipulate the mathematics efficiently and effectively, well, then I think it's absolutely 100% essential that you're using the most accurate vocabulary possible, because the words have been chosen to describe complex scenarios. And so where a word, for instance, the word quotient, replaces 20, perhaps misaligned words, well, then use the one word. Use the mathematical word that explains the concept and expect that they will understand in the same way they'll understand in phonics. You know, that's the examples often given. Pupils understand what a digraph is and can talk about that reasonably well, you know, when they're 5, 6 years old. So why not in maths? So I think where our pupils really need teacher instruction, where pupils really need support in grasping mathematics, we've got the tools, and the language is one of those tools, to really support them in developing their understanding of these really abstract concepts. So it might not be fair, because I reckon most people find themselves in a situation where they will need to utilize the full depth and range of our mathematical vocabulary, but it's only going to lead to more proficient mathematicians going forward.
It's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, I think there is an extent to which you have to expose pupils to like the variety of different ways that the four operations are going to be described. You know, they're going to hear someone say the product of, or the, you know, or this multiplied by this, or this times by this, or this many lots of this. And so they have to see this in all kinds of contexts. The question is, obviously we want kids to experience this variety of language so that they're familiar with it. The question is, you know, are we happy with that language being used when we're describing something purely abstract on a board that isn't, you know, when you see 7 times 5 equals 35, and we're not talking about lots of stuff, is it okay to still say that that means, oh, well, that's 7 lots of 5 equals 35? I don't think it's necessarily problematic. I have to say that I tend in my own practice, when I'm talking about something abstract on the board, and it's just abstract numbers, it's not applied to, as it were, real life context, I tend to fall back on particular vocabulary that I'll use every time, because I think it supports pupils to understand what's going on, you know, when they're initially learning it. So if I'm looking at, I don't know, balancing equations in a simple way, so you've got 7 plus 5 equals blank plus 4 or whatever. If I'm using, when I'm introducing that, if I'm using slightly subtly different language for question 1, question 2, question 3, question 4, like in the first one, I'm using plus and minus, and then in the second one, I'm saying add and subtract, I might be distracting from the thing that I want them to focus on. So I think for me, the balance there is that I try and keep the language consistent if I'm introducing something new that isn't about that language. And then as soon as I'm kind of in more confident areas and I'm taking it further afield, I'm then just freer in the different ways that I describe multiplication, division, subtraction, and addition. Just because I think they need that exposure, but you've got to be careful when you're giving them that variety to not have any sense of, not to place unnecessary load on what they're trying to learn.
Yeah, I mean, I've gone one step further in the past and expect consistent use of language across the school. You know, your language needs to be forward facing as much as your representation selection. And so plus, minus, multiplied by will be consistent across the school so that pupils aren't having to deal with new terminology, except when we want them to learn new terminology, you know, like the definitions for flat and curved and things. You know, pupils are encountering these in reception. Needs to be consistent. It can't be I'm trying to think of an example, but essentially for us, a face is a flat surface. And so shapes that do not have flat surfaces, the number of faces will change compared with regular definitions or more common definitions. And so, yeah, I think that across the school, 100%, everyone's singing from the same hymn sheet. And it is just in your those rapid fire moments when you know you're working with someone who understands this bit, but it's actually this bit we need to get to, you might slip out of it. But it's really important that we focus on that as we go forward.
I get the sense you've been down the same rabbit holes I have with regards to how many faces does a cylinder have and this sort of thing, because it's odd, isn't it? Because with mathematics, you kind of assume that at the bottom of it all is, no, there must be 100% agreed upon definitions for every word that's used in mathematics. And then you follow this stuff down, you're like, oh, no, there isn't. There are genuinely different ways to use the word face, and it depends upon the circumstances that we might be using that in. But that goes so much deeper than what we're talking about in our primary curriculum that actually makes way more sense for us to say, you're right, as a team, we are defining a face as a flat surface that isn't curved. We're defining a side as something that can't be curved, for example. And obviously that has an impact if you're talking about if you're talking about a cylinder, then does it have three faces or does it have two? And there isn't a correct answer to that. And necessarily, it depends how you as a mathematician are using the word face. Yeah, I spent kind of 45 minutes kind of going down weird little, as soon as you end up on like these little chat things, yeah, like Stack yeah. Exchange, you've got mathematicians talking to each other. It's like, yeah, this is the point at which I need to check out, because you're talking about, I don't know, non-Euclidean topology. And I'm like, yeah, I'm done. I'm out. But it suffices to say that it does appear that it's one of these things where it's worth us being consistent, but in the back of our mind, it's worth us recognizing that that consistency is a pedagogical tool rather than something that necessarily has a precise definition amongst mathematicians.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, because the circle's an interesting one, because obviously we defined a side is a line between two points, or a straight line between two points. Circle has an infinite number of those, and there are certain things online where, you know, you can add the number of sides, and the closer to infinity, the closer to a circle you get. And I think around 100, it starts looking like a 100 side shape looks like pretty much like a circle. But to my knowledge, there's no proof for working back the other way. So you couldn't start with the idea that there's infinite number of sides and then show that, you know. So like you say, mathematicians on those chat rooms, I think the Wolf from Alpha one might have a chat room as well. And yeah, it gets really deep and you're all, okay, for us, zero sides because there's no straight lines or too many straight lines for us to count. But that definition continues on then when they're working with them geometric properties in year 5 and 6 and stuff like that. So makes total sense. Probably best to call it there. Although I know I had one more for you and you probably had one more for me. But in the interests of a nice, short, sharp episode, I think probably makes sense to call it here. So all it's left to do is say thank you to those people who sent in questions. My apologies for my abysmal, I don't know, return rate of Twitter DMs. But I promise you, it is an absolute nightmare in there. And it seems like recently there have been more and more unsolicited requests for my attention from bots and things like that there. But I will try my absolute best. And I hope that us answering these questions has gone somewhere to making up for the fact that I did not respond in good time. Thank you very much for joining me, Chris.
Always a pleasure.
And everyone at home, until next time, thanks for listening.